You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The Biden administration announced it's launching a new White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. President Biden said on Friday that the office will have four main objectives.
First, to expedite the implementation of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act and the executive actions already announced. And I mean it. We're going to fully implement them. Second, coordinate more support for survivors, families, and communities affected by gun violence, including mental health care, financial assistance, the same way FEMA responds to natural disasters. Same way. And helps folks recover and rebuild and alter. Look, folks, shootings are the ultimate superstorm, ripping through communities. Third, identify new executive actions we can take within our legal authority to reduce gun violence. And fourth, expand our coalition of partners in states and cities across America.
The Biden administration has pushed for an assault weapons ban and other gun control legislation, but has gotten little movement from Congress outside of the bipartisan Safer Communities Act passed last year. Gun safety advocates are praising the formation of the office as a step in the right direction in the absence of further legislative action. According to the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation, the U.S. stands out among high-income countries around the world. Quoting from a report last year, age-adjusted firearm homicide rates in the U.S. are 22 times greater than in the European Union, 23 times greater than in Australia. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the White House forming this Office of Gun Violence Prevention? Do you think it could make a difference? What would you want to see from the White House? And how about from Congress when it comes to preventing gun violence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Theodore Lentz is an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at UW-Milwaukee. He researches the criminal legal system, gun violence, and community justice. Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Big picture, how significant is this to have this White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention?
Big picture, I think this is a really positive step forward. Anytime you're bringing more resources to address any issue or any problem that we're having, you know, it signals that more effort is going to be put into this problem. You know, of course, it depends the degree to which it's going to make a difference is going to depend on what they're actually going to do, how much funding will be coming through them, what the funding will be used for, et cetera. But I think it's an important step and an important signal that we're going to start taking gun violence more seriously.
When we look over the last few decades, we've saw peaks in homicides, often gun homicides in the 80s and 90s. They declined for a while, went back up in conjunction with COVID. But compared, as I mentioned in that report, to other countries, our rates are generally pretty high compared to other comparable nations like in Europe, in Australia. Do we pay attention to that number? Is this just something we take for granted in the U.S., do you think?
I don't know. I mean, Americans, you know, tend to think of us as an outlier, and I think that we are an outlier, certainly when it comes to gun violence. And I think that it's an important sign of something. I mean, in American culture, I think that gun violence is part of it in a lot of ways, and the, you know, widespread availability of firearms. You know, there's a lot of reasons why we as a country have a much larger problem with gun violence than others.
We heard President Biden there list the fourth point, aiming at expanding a coalition of partners in states and cities across America to deal with gun violence. You've done some work, I understand, with community groups aimed at preventing gun violence victimization. Can you talk about what kind of programs you've seen?
Yeah, sure. The community-based approaches to gun violence prevention tend to work. They use sort of a different strategy. Usually it's a more of a public health approach to gun violence prevention. And that approach is kind of identifying, well, you know, what is the problem? What are the causes and the risk factors? And then, you know, when we find out what works to address some of those, what do we do about it? And community-based approaches are, I would say, increasingly being used across the U.S., where you're really bringing the existing community resources into the strategy, rather than relying entirely, for instance, on law enforcement to use, you know, what they typically do, you know, which is investigate incidents, making arrests, things like that. The public health approach, the, you know, community-based approaches, that they also violence interruption, for instance, is one common strategy. Violence interruption works on this idea that you know, there, that gun violence, it's not a random event. It's concentrated in geographic space. There are certain places that are at much higher risk than other places, and it's also concentrated among people. A lot of times, when you look at perpetrators of gun violence, it's a relatively small number of people that are believed to be responsible for the majority of the violence. And so identifying who those people are, and then finding ways to interrupt the potential, the violent conflicts. In some cities we're seeing where these community organizations are hiring folks from the community, people that can serve sort of as credible messengers to bring about a, you know, a message of nonviolence and trying to stop the violence. And they can also work with hospitals, trauma centers. We see that here in Milwaukee, where there are dedicated folks, staff members at hospitals that are responding to when someone comes in with a shooting injury, and they're able then to kind of figure out what services are needed, how to provide more support for that individual, for their families, their friends, and their community. You know, it's another touch point where we can start to get down into what are the underlying causes, what sort of social context is allowing violence to thrive in this way. And so thinking outside of just law enforcement strategies is one way that that we're seeing some promise.
When I've talked to other people about violence interrupter programs, it seems like some communities have had a pattern that goes something like this. A community gets grants to start up a program like this. It shows some signs of promise. The grant runs out. They scramble to sustain it, but without the initial funding, it's hard to keep going. Are you hoping that maybe something like this announcement from the White House could start to create more sustainable frameworks where you do it not just for whatever, a 3-year grant period or something, but have a permanent sort of violence interruption program?
That's a great point. That tends to be the case where you have, some soft money that's supporting these initiatives. And then, sometimes it takes a while too. Some of trying to change cultural norms around the use of firearms and violence to settle disputes and things like that, it can take some time. And so, sustainability of these programs is really hard. They tend to be really expensive. It takes a lot of people power. It takes a lot of institutional power to maintain these programs and these initiatives. And so, yes, definitely. And it, you know, back to the first point that, anytime you're going to potentially bring more resources to the issue, it should be it can be a positive thing, because that is kind of the Achilles heel of a lot of community-based prevention work.
Talking to Ted Lentz, assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at UW-Milwaukee, talking about efforts to bring down gun violence in the United States. The White House announced a new Office for Gun Violence Prevention late last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think might work? What do you worry about when you hear about programs like this? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Mark?
Well, so on the surface, it sounds great, you know, a new government office to address what's obviously a serious problem, living in a major metropolitan city. You know, clearly gun violence is a problem. But even in the president's message, he seems to be rolling like his whole agenda into one. He mentioned these, what we call the so-called assault weapon ban, because nobody can really define what an assault weapon is. You know, there's supposed to be checks and balance. That's checks and balances. That's where government was set up. And the ATF is clearly overreached. The governor of New Mexico recently tried a huge overreach, and they're using this public health emergency concept that worked so well during COVID to try to exert executive power over things that the legislature doesn't want to take on.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there from Mark. The New Mexico issue, he mentioned the governor, the latest there, I think declared a public health effort, saying that overrides the ability of people to carry guns publicly. Ted, as Mark mentioned, a lot of checks and balances issues, a lot of constitutional issues that we might run up against as we try to think of solutions to gun violence. Does that make things complicated, or do you think there's a lot of room to work even within that?
A little bit of both. Obviously, those constitutional issues, the political issues that are just historically and contemporarily making it difficult for developing policy. But I think, you know, taking a bit of a step back in the broader context of, you know, if we are kind of taking this public health approach, I mean, we've identified a problem, right? We're starting to collect systematically more data so we can start tracking, is this problem getting bigger? Is it getting smaller? You know, who's affected? You know, are there important disparities to consider, et cetera? And then once you're able to do that, then you start thinking about, well, what are the causes and the risk factors? Before you can start talking about, well, what works and how do we do more of what works? And so I think at least the research community is, you know, we're just starting to get into the what works question, starting to do more evaluations. You know, there are obviously case studies and things like that we can work from, but we still don't have a good sense of what works. There was a big effort by a private research organization at one point to look at gun policies and their effects. And basically the research is not strong enough to make any firm conclusions about what works and what doesn't. And so, you know, from a researcher standpoint, I think that the research community is in a really important place right now where, you know, we do need the resources in order to start tapping into these questions and trying to answer them so that we can develop policies that are rooted in what we know about gun violence.
We're talking to UW-Milwaukee criminal justice and criminology professor Ted Lentz about the White House launching a new office for gun violence prevention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important an issue is gun violence prevention to you? Whose responsibility is it to reduce gun violence? Do you want to see the Biden administration and or Congress do more to tackle the issue? Have you seen efforts maybe in your own community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ted Lentz. He's an assistant professor of criminal justice and criminology at UW-Milwaukee, who studies gun violence, community response, and the criminal legal system. He's with us today for a look at the newly announced White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention, what impact it might have on the issue, and what we do and don't know about preventing gun violence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Eau Claire. Chris, hi.
Hi. So I'm very much in favor of this initiative by the White House. I feel that we have to take more and more creative ways to combat this issue. I think that we have been kind of beat up and cornered with our own Constitution. These Second Amendment advocates have kind of put us in a position where we have no other choice but to do this. So I hope that the funding is there. I hope that it stays, and I hope that it grows. I think this is one solution of many we have to go after.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Ted, does our divisive politics when it comes to guns and gun control interfere, you think, with the work you were talking about earlier of trying to figure out causes of gun violence and measure solutions and whether and how they work?
I mean, it gets in the way insofar as it prevents the resources, the funding needed to do good research. You know, if the funding is not there, or it's very, you know, inconsistent and unstable, it makes it difficult to really evaluate a program or a strategy or a policy for its effectiveness. You know, in the same way that we would, you know, we got to know how, you know, it's about creating data systems and things like that, again, to track changes over time, so that we can start identifying the ones that do and don't work. And if we're constantly kind of taking our foot off the gas, it leaves these gaps in the research. It leaves gaps in, you know, if you think of it like a public health problem, in the dosage of the treatment that communities are receiving. You know, if that's intermittent and it's not consistent, it's not stable, that makes it really hard not only for the program or the policy to work or to be effective as it was intended to be, but also for the research community to be able to give us some better answers as to the effectiveness questions.
Thanks a lot for that call. We heard President Biden earlier refer to that previously passed piece of legislation, the bipartisan Safer Communities Act. One of the things that does is go out and works with schools, or at least that's the goal, giving grants to schools to, quote, create, to establish safer and healthier learning environments, prevent and respond to acts of bullying, violence, and hate, and also to give mental health support to schools. Ted, how much can we do at the school level when it comes to supporting students and, I guess, using the educational process to help prevent violence?
Well, I think it's really important to get as many folks at the table as we can to deal with this problem. It's not just a law enforcement problem. It's not just a mental health system problem. It's not just an education, educational or you know, a lot of systems are kind of implicated in this. And they're all intertwined. And so, yeah, I think that working with the schools and ensuring, you know, because gun violence is concentrated in places and among people who, you know, tend to have many other of these sort of co-occurring outcomes co-occurring negative outcomes. And so when we think of gun violence prevention, it could be, you know, the other pieces to that puzzle might be better access to healthcare and food security. It could be, you know, housing access, education. All of these systems are kind of related to one another. They're all affecting one another. And so if we can leverage the resources of other systems, I think that's a really good way about to go about it.
We'll go back to our callers now. Terry joins us in Fifield. Terry, hi.
Hey, hi. My question is really kind of simple. This is all on gun violence, but if you take away the guns, they're going to grab a knife. If you take away the knife, they're going to grab a club. Why aren't we just delving in on the problem of violence and getting rid of that?
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. I'm looking at an FBI chart. Their most recent date is 2019. About three quarters of homicides in the U.S. are guns, firearms of one sort or another. But Terry raises a really interesting question, Ted. Is this a gun violence problem or is it a gun violence problem? Should we be talking about preventing violence more generally, or is there something particular about gun violence that we're worried about?
I think it's both. I think a lot of the violence prevention efforts more generally, work for gun violence as well. And so I think that the nature of the violence problem, especially here in America, being gun violence, it's a question. The research community has been dealing with this for a long time. Some people refer to it as firearm instrumentality, and thinking about, well, you know, right, if somebody is motivated enough to engage in violence, it doesn't really matter what tool they use. And it's hard to say in a given event or incident whether if the gun wouldn't have been present had the violence still happened. One thing that we do have some there's considerable evidence out there suggesting, though, that firearms do make violent encounters more lethal. And so when we're thinking of loss of life, as opposed to having a non-fatal violent encounter, the research is pretty clear that the presence of a firearm does make these encounters more lethal. And so when we think of the ability to injure and or kill somebody from a further distance away, when you look at fatal shootings versus non-fatal shootings, a lot of times there's not a whole lot of difference in sort of the contextual or the situational characteristics of the incidents. And so what that tells us then is that at the same time, when you do have more wounds, the placement of the wounds,
I will have to leave it there. Sorry, Ted Lentz is Assistant Professor of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UW-Milwaukee. Regular listeners know that we're big fans here at Central Time of the brown bears at Katmai National Park in Alaska. The bears are the stars of a series of online nature cameras. And this is a big time of year with Fat Bear Week voting just around the corner. It's been a dramatic season, including a later than usual salmon run, some confrontations at Brooks Falls, and the long-awaited return of fan favorite 420 Otis. Now the public, you can get involved in voting. If you want to get in, just look up Fat Bear Week online. You'll find a pre-vote survey, links to the online cameras. Then over the next couple of weeks, you can vote in bracket-style competitions, first for Fat Bear Jr., the youth competition, then the full-on Fat Bear Week competition to honor the bear that did the best job gorging on salmon to get ready for winter. Watched a lot this year. I'm not a gambling person, but if I were, my money would be on 128 Grazer. Did a great job of catching fish on the lip of the falls, and she didn't put up with nonsense from anyone. There are a lot of great contenders, though. Search online for Fat Bear Week. Get in the game. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an iconic building in eastern Wisconsin.
On the western coast of Lake Michigan sits the city of Manitowoc, a place known for its deep connection with the water. And along its shore, a lighthouse, essential to the area's maritime history, stands tall, watching over the city. Molly Hunkin climbed inside to take us on a tour.
Okay, well, welcome to Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. You're about half a mile out in the lake here. Ludington is about 60 miles across the lake, straight over here. So you're out in the center of things here.
Paul Reckel is a member of Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary, a locally based group which organizes fundraising events for the community. Within the past decade, they have also become the official caretakers of the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse. The lighthouse was built in 1918, making it over 100 years old. Its name comes from the structure that it's built on.
When you walked out here on the concrete, that's the breakwater. And basically what that is, it separates the lake from the harbor, and it makes a safe place for the ships to come in and be protected.
The building itself has 5 stories. Its first floor is a basement, which used to act as storage and a boathouse. In this portion of the basement was a dory, a small boat which lighthouse keepers used for rescues.
But you can read stories on it where the lighthouse keepers in its day would take care of the rescues out on the lake when they occurred. And even in the middle of winter, tremendous blizzard, at night, no lights, they had to listen to the sounds and actually push the boat out, hop in it, and go out and rescue the people and then bring it back in.
On the second floor, the motor room housed the motor to generate power for the light on top. Above that sits the watch room, where lighthouse keepers used radio equipment to keep in touch with boats out on the lake. In cases of stormy weather, sometimes lighthouse keepers stayed overnight in cots in this room, though they normally slept on shore. The diaphone room on the fourth floor used to be the location of the foghorn, also called a diaphone. Ships could activate the diaphone from the lake to warn of their arrival on shore. From the deck outside, you can see the Badger Car Ferry, which has been running since the 1950s, beginning its round trip between Manitowoc and Ludington, Michigan.
That's two toots like that, that's a salute to us. Thank you.
After a brief climb up a small metal ladder, you reach what most people would think of when imagining a lighthouse, the lens house.
That's where the light that signals to the ships is located. And this particular light could be seen from 17 miles out in the lake, which is by no means...
The small room on top of the lighthouse holds no more than the light itself, with enough space for a few people around it. The expansive view looks out over Lake Michigan and the city of Manitowoc. After the need for lighthouse keepers disappeared, the building became run down. It succumbed to vandalism and the wear and tear expected for a building in the middle of a lake. But in 2011, the Manitowoc North Breakwater Lighthouse was put on auction by the Coast Guard. It was purchased by a man from Long Island, New York, named Philip Carlucci, for $30,000.
When you buy a property from the Coast Guard, you have to bring it up to standards and maintain it. So he stuck over $325,000 into it to get it in the condition it is in today.
The owner and Manitowoc Sunrise Rotary are collaborating with the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, also located in Manitowoc, to return historical objects and equipment to the building. Looking forward, the owner hopes to continue restoring the lighthouse to its original state.
Molly Hunkin brought us that story on the Manitowoc Breakwater Lighthouse. The building itself is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, our broadcasting license from the FCC doesn't allow us to curse on the radio, but swearing is more acceptable in some workplaces than others. You might not want to swear at your boss, but it might be less of a big deal if you drop a profanity around a trusted coworker. Cursing has long been viewed as unprofessional or inappropriate, but it's become more commonplace in other environments as social and cultural norms have changed. Timothy Jay is Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. He's the author of 6 books on cursing, language, and inappropriate behavior. He's a widely cited expert on swearing. I talked to him earlier this year. Now, what is it? You've done a lot of work on swearing and cursing. What is it about swearing that, as a psychologist, you find so interesting?
Well, it's the speakable taboo. We're not supposed to do it, but everybody knows how to swear. And children know how to swear. So it's the one kind of language you learn very early on, but you're not allowed to use it. And I think it's the taboo nature of it. It's that, you know, that the edge of proper language, and you know, like, where is that line? Where is it appropriate? What does it tell us about people and how they interact? How are cultures different? How does the brain mature to do this? There's so many questions that are interesting to me as a scientist that every time I found the answer to one question, a dozen more would pop up. That's why it's interesting to me.
Now, there's a handful of common words that might pop to mind when we think of cursing and swearing. What is it that leads a word to be promoted or demoted, however you want to think of it, to one of those words?
Well, it's all convention. These are all standards that have evolved over centuries, and they have mainly to do with religion, sexuality, relationships with ancestors, animal names, and sort of disgusting things that come out of your body. Those cover even globally, the categories of words that that become taboo. And the English-speaking countries, these words have been fairly stable for years. The four-letter words, these are 1,000 years old. So these are conventions or standards that are passed on from generation to generation, and they're policed by what I call the institutions of power. Like religion, education, mass media all have standards. And the fact that these institutions of power punish people or reprimand people for using these language makes them remain powerful.
We're talking to Timothy Jay, psychologist expert on swearing and taboo language. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your thoughts on the use of profane language. Do you see more of it than you used to? Where is it appropriate? Is it ever appropriate? What do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I want to talk about context in which we use these words, Timothy. In my job on the radio, if I use certain words, I'm subjecting our station to potentially very big fines and me getting fired. If I use a profanity, say, at band practice, I might be, I don't know, building solidarity with the guys. Can you talk about the importance of context in determining when and where we say these words?
Yeah, that's the examples you gave are good. Context is the end all and the be all of using this kind of language. What a word means, how offensive it is, depends entirely on context, the who, what, where, and when. And as these variables shift, whether language is appropriate, offensive language is appropriate or not, it also shifts.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Morgan is with us in Eau Claire. Morgan, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for this. It really caught my attention just because I have a 5-year-old and she loves to express herself. I will, occasionally say, the four-letter swear word, but like more like in excitement or just more to express myself. And I've noticed just as she gets older, she'll say it kind of just more casually than maybe some people would be comfortable with. So I guess just my question was, do you feel like that is something that is okay for her to be able to express? Or I guess I'm not sure what the line is between it being appropriate or being not appropriate.
Morgan, thanks. You're talking to a guy who wrote a book called What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty. What would you tell her, Timothy?
Yeah, every parent should anticipate this. By the time the kids go off to school, they probably have a vocabulary of about 40 different words that they've learned from their listening to their parents and to their friends. They might use these kind of words more with their friends than around their parents. But I think that's a great occasion for you, Meredith, to express your family values. And I think the best thing is to remain cool. Don't overreact. That only makes the words more powerful and gives the kids the, I can push mom's buttons with these words. Remain cool. Ask them about their emotions. Why are you using this word? Are you angry? You can also just say, I'm angry. But I think you want to keep the door open as a mother to talk about not only words, but also what's going to happen in a few years as the sexual terms will come in. And you don't want to be repressive about that. You know, you want to be, if you want to communicate your values about religion or sexuality, I think that's your role as a parent. So anticipate it, be cool about it. But if you have rules about this, then if the kid breaks the rule, then there are consequences. So I think it's an integral part of parenting. But what surprised me in the psychological literature, especially developmental psychology, there was no mention of this in scientific literature. That's why one of the reasons why I wrote the book, What to Do When Your Kids Talk Dirty, is every parent knows this is important. And also, besides the four-letter words, it's like, how do I talk about my body? How do I talk about the things that come out of my body? You know, how does my family talk about these things? So take that as a role as a parent and as an educator to teach values to your daughter.
Thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to psychologist Timothy Jay with the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts about cursing and the cultural norms around naughty words. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about swearing? Do you think people should let loose and say what they want? When, where, what environment is the right time to swear, if any? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some more of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Timothy Jay, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, author of many books on the subject of cursing and swearing. He's with us today to talk about why we swear, how different social environments affect the language we use. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in the Beloit area. Bob, hello.
Why, hello. So I just wanted to bring this up. My mom is going to be 101 in March, still living at home, and she started a cussing club probably when she was in her 80s. And her theory behind it was to bring all the friends and people over. They could come in, they could cuss, they could get everything out of their system. And she kind of thought that people, when they got older with dementia, then wouldn't be doing that as much because they felt free to get that out at this point. I just thought that was a interesting vision, and there's no scientific evidence behind it, obviously, but I'm curious about what your speaker's thoughts are on that.
Well, and Bob, I gotta ask, have you been to one of these, or were you not invited as you know, a kid, not one of the peers?
I was not invited. This was something my mom did with her a bunch of her lady friends, and primarily started because one of her friends was getting dementia and was starting to cuss and use some languages. And this made her feel more comfortable bringing her in and doing social functions when everybody could come in and just
Bob, that is super interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Timothy, I'm gonna guess there may not be a lot of research on this, but what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think it's also part of what we're seeing now, more women swearing generally as more women are in the workplace, more women in public. Sort of a more empowerment of women to use this, what I would call powerful language. Certainly, if you're going to work in a high pressure context like a law firm, the women in the law firm are going to pick this up. But with regard to aging, although I can never imagine my mother doing this, I was raised in a very religious family. I never heard my mother swear, although my father was a bricklayer, and I heard him swear, especially at work. But we have studied cursing in nursing homes, and what he reported is happening. What is happening is there in a nursing home, you have sort of, with dementia, you have a reversion to childhood, and the people with dementia become very childlike. They're not as careful about their bath habits, and they revert to the emotional language of childhood. If the person is bilingual, they usually will revert to swearing in their native language. But this is common in nursing home settings, especially in the dementia wings, and where you will see them using the language of their childhood. So what we recorded about 20 years ago in the nursing homes was we didn't have the offensive language that teenagers use now. It was mainly profanity, words like Jesus, damn, goddamn, words like that. It will be interesting to see when the younger generation reaches the nursing home and has dementia. I would imagine the kind of language we'll hear in another 40 or 50 years is going to be a lot worse now. But the use of profanity during dementia is common, along with a other sort of childlike behavior.
Bob, thanks for sharing that story. Tom is with us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I have a question for your guest. I'm under the impression that a lot of swear words covering taboo subjects, that the culture, whatever the culture it is that's using those words, they tend to borrow the words from other cultures. Somehow, for one's own culture, it's demeaning to use words to cover perhaps sexual subjects, and so you borrow words from other cultures.
Tom, interesting. Thanks. Timothy, is that something that we happen to use loan words for some of these ideas?
Well, I think of the lexicon of swearing like a garden. And there are some plants in there that are ancient, and like the F word and the S word. Those words have been around for 1,000. They grew up in Anglo-Saxon culture, but also influenced by German and Italian. So there is some borrowing. Where I see that obviously today is the expansion of hip hop culture around the world, globally, where you have people that are saying American swear words that they pick up in hip hop from music and other genres of hip hop. And they, you know, it's common to hear this in Sweden or Germany or Switzerland, to hear swear words being appropriated. This is happening now more than ever because of the global expansion of entertainment media and film and music, but also the internet.
Tom, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Interesting point. Talking to Timothy J., psychologist, expert on swearing. Back to your calls. Adam was with us in River Falls. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Yeah, interesting topic. Growing up on a farm, there was lots of cursing down in the barn when things did not go well. But my mom made sure we did not use those words in the house. So my question is, how much control do we have over these words? And as I'm raising little boys now, and you mentioned kids earlier on, are there any tactics in helping make sure that those words don't come up or aren't used as much as they can be?
Well, I think on that last note, I think you should expect them to come up. Every competent speaker of English knows all these swear words. I think what you need to engage them is in a discussion of etiquette. Language has styles, like clothing has styles, and where you learn where it's appropriate and where it's not appropriate. I had the same kind of division of labor in my house where what happened at work was different than what happened at the dinner table. And I think by the time boys are adolescents, they need to learn that what you can say in the backyard, what you can say in the barn is different than what you can say at work or at school. That's just part of, you know, learning your culture. And I think sometimes, like when things go wrong anywhere in the barn or on the golf course or at work, and we become frustrated, it seemed to be there's sort of a natural reflexive use of this, like the hammer on the thumb idea. So that kind of stuff, I think, is a habit which is kind of drilled into you, or that you've practiced enough that it becomes almost automatic. Whereas other times, I think answering the question about control is a matter of, should I use this kind of language or tell this kind of joke in this situation? And there's where you where it's not like the hammer on the thumb. It's more like what I call strategic use of this. Like, that's not a good idea to say that here, or maybe I should say that here because I'm angry.
Adam, thanks for that call. And Timothy, thanks again for joining us today.
As I said, I'm darn glad to be here and tell your listeners to support public radio. I do.
Timothy Jay is professor of psychology at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts and author of many books on swearing, including Why We Curse. I talked to him earlier this year about changing norms of swearing, especially in the workplace. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, kids in school face a lot of pressure to perform in academics and activities. Has it gone too far? Meet the author of the new book, Never Enough, When Achievement Culture Becomes Toxic and What We Can Do About It. And it's apple season. A Wisconsin historian shares the unique history of the fruit here in the state and beyond. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up after the news, John Grisham, George R.R. Martin, and other high-profile authors are suing the creators of so-called artificial intelligence programs for scanning and then imitating their works. Find out what's at stake for the creative world and the books we read. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.